Clearly, that's probably what it was. And it might just not have had the energy that night for Mr. Twain. So, but the
something for Mark Twain to kind of jump on then.
Yeah, I don't think Dickens ever saw his stand-up act. So I don't think Dickens had.
It could have been a little rivalry there.
exactly.
Now, Tom, you've had a long and successful career as an actor, a screenwriter. You teach story and screenwriting. What do you think makes A Christmas Carol so successful, so enduring as both a story and a performance piece? You mentioned the melodrama parts of it, and I think in the past you've also mentioned it's also a ghost story, which
it
gets
is.
Our attention.
Yeah, indeed. It is there is a grand tradition of holiday ghost stories in Victorian times. And of course, Victorians loved ghost stories. I mean, if you think about it, the early Victorian period, it's a world lit only by fire. So if you've ever been in a place where it's just fire illuminating things, you know that in the corner there, there's a ghost, you know, in the flickering of that candle. So
right, a dancing flame.
Yeah, and with death so present to the Victorians, it was not hard to imagine that they would have had a fascination with ghosts. And so, yes, Dickens conceived this as basically a ghost story, the haunting of a man. But I think the genius of the story is that I think as human beings, we love, and we can see it in our politics too. I mean, we love a redemption story. We love someone who has been redeemed from point A to point Z. And certainly Scrooge is that, someone who has completely changed overnight from, you know, the covetous old sinner to someone who was, a good friend to all. So I think that's the eternal appeal of it. I mean, it takes place at the end of the year because it's the holiday, and you know we reflect at New Year's on ourselves and just on our own journey in life. And I think that Christmas Carol frames that for us as as our own self-reflection of where we are and what we want to change and. Do we have time to do that? And the reminder that we better take the time because that, you know, shrouded figure of the ghost of Christmas yet to come, you know, pointing down to the gravestone is there to remind us that time is not eternal, that we only have a certain amount of time to do good for our fellow man. And I think that people want to do that. And I think that's the eternal appeal of Christmas Carol.
Well, Tom, again, many thanks for joining us today. I wonder if Mr. Dickens would be kind enough to leave us with a few words of holiday cheer.
Ah, sure, absolutely. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
We've been talking with Tom Bray, who will be performing the Portland holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, a Victorian reading, this Saturday, December 21st, 2 p.m., at the Coho Theater, 2257 Northwest Raleigh in Portland. You can find out more online and purchase tickets at cohoproductions.org or pdxchristmas.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we bring you a range of community-oriented programming built by community members like you.
Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
Hey everybody, tune in Saturday, December 21st at 5 o'clock for Blues Junction. We're spreading some holiday cheer with singer-songwriter Mark Lemhouse. He's a blues man, and he's got some new music coming out here. I've invited him to come out and do a live performance and interview, and who knows, maybe he'll squeeze in a holiday tune. So again, that's Mark Lemhouse, Saturday, December 21st. You're invited. Winter's now fading,
and I won't have to stay here too. You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. We've got music and much more coming up for you. It's Again, we're excited to be with you today for this episode of Low Res Edition as we continue our quarantine shows. Thank you so much for tuning in. We're very happy that you're sticking with us through these hard times, and we're hoping that we're bringing you some good feels, some education, some memories of home, or whatever it may be. Good tidings to you and your own as we continue to navigate whatever 2020 is. Anyways, all that to be said and more coming up. Starting off the show, we have Indian Nick with Electric Indians here on Rose City Native Radio.
Thank you. than just survivors. Tradition, dreams that I've been chasing. Ambition, breaking my
poverty, your heart to see my sovereignty, causing me to follow G.O.D. philosophy, yeah. Constantly gossiping, no equality or harmony. Can I get a job? No, you can't, you're not related, man. I hate to see it when I'm animated, get faded, a native awaited, say it, so debated or play it. Everything in life has a price and it's spiritual. You pay it, lay it down and spray the clouds with lyrical spiritual flow. Just to let you know it's all my chest, but you don't hear me, though. We keep on rocking and shocking, cause the time is ticking, talking, and we locking it down. Feel you open, we keep knocking wood.
Indian.
Super Indian. Cal Van Eric.
I love this part, Hubert. Watch.
Brother, I make
a white eyes pay. You take them flaming arrows to the prairie.
General Bear, Indians don't talk like that.
Cal Van Eric does. He's an Indian with three names.
He didn't talk like that in the Smoke Jumpers movie.
Humor, Cal Van Eric was like that in Moccasin Force and Geronimo, first Indian on the moon.
I hate when they mess with the timeline.
Yes, it's time for Super Indian. With each attempt to disrupt life on the Leaning Oak Reservation, evil villain Wampum Bags has come closer to defeating his mentor, tribal medicine woman Flora Logan. Wampum dispatches his most famous evil associate. Hubert is cleaning ashtrays at the bingo hall, blissfully unaware of the danger that awaits him.
Oh, dang, must be my Uncle Chester. Hello?
Hubert, it's Uncle Chester. I'm at the tribal bank, and Lena Marie is withdrawing a bunch of money.
That's nosy, Uncle Chester.
Ah, Hubert, it's a company check. Oh. She's with Chief Yellowshirt, Cal Van Eric, and some Hollywood hot body.
Cal Van Eric here? Uncle Chester, he's the most famous Indian on the planet.
Oh, he's an Indian in the movies, isn't it? But how do we know Calvin Eric is really Indian? Huh. The internet says he's Chumash Paiute Ojibwe with a Romanian mother. Oh. But it could be Mantan and a wig. Mm. Oh, wait! They're heading over to the bingo hall. Get Mega Bear and DOG.
You got it, Uncle Chester.
Meanwhile, Chief Jerry Yellowshirt and Lena Marie show off the bingo hall to their Hollywood guests.
And this is our newly renovated bingo hall, Cal Van Eric. We spent over $5,000 on custom linoleum.
Your tribal logo is in every square.
It's custom.
For the movie, we'll recreate the bingo hall of 1992 instead of this generic Native Americana.
Generic?
49 Productions, Sage speaking.
Sage, it's Rumpum Biggs. I trust everything is evil.
Everything is going as planned.
Tell Calvin Eric I'll be there very soon.
Calvin Eric, our benefactor is on his way.
He is. I'm honored. Chief Yellowshirt, is Mrs. Logan meeting us here?
Oh, yeah, sure. She's over by the coffee machine.
Come, Sage. My producer really wants to meet Mrs. Logan.
Oh, I get it. I'm cut from the movie because of that old woman.
No, Chief, you weren't never in it. They're filming the Lena Marie story first.
Mrs. Logan, what a pleasure. I'm Cal Van Eric, the Indian with three names, star of Smoke Jumpers and Wagon Wheel of Death. I'm rarely recognized, sans buckskin.
Oh, Andy. Nice to meet you, Mr. Van Eric.
That's Cal Van Eric. Please, use all three of my names.
Mistress Flora Logan, so we meet again.
Wampum, baby, I thought you had confidence in me.
Calvin Eric, this is between me and the medicine woman.
But I was about to show them my highlight reel and then clean out their tribal bank.
Calvin Eric, you've been like an evil son to me, but it's time you know the truth. I engineered your successful movie career.
Ah, here they are, Lena. Oh.
And I even bought your tribal enrollment card.
Oh! Wampum Banks, I knew you'd be back. I'm ready for you. Take that!
Oh! No!
You feel that, Banks? I got more where that came from.
Feel my power, medicine woman!
My God, Bag, she's an old woman. She can't last long pinned to the ceiling like that. Lena, let's get out of here.
All right.
How long can Grandma Logan hold out pinned to the ceiling? The conclusion of our story in the next astonishing Super Indian adventure.
Super Indian.
A Native Voices at the Autry production.
That was your favorite superhero and mine, Super Indian. You can find more information at superindiancomics.com. It's also a good time to remind you that you too can help support community radio by going to kboo.fm/give and donate today to support programs like this one and many others. We've been proudly serving Turtle Island interviews, music, and more for over 6 years, and we're looking forward to another 6, another 10, another 20 years, continuing the over 30-year tradition of Indigenous programming here on KBOO, in the path of the late, great John Talley himself, who started Indian World back all the way in 1968 or 70. It's been a while. And that program continued until 2012. And we are continuing on a legacy of Indigenous programming and voices here. And we are happy that you're here listening to us. So again, if you like what you hear, if you learn something, if we remind you of home, if you just want to help support, you know, community voices and uplifting those who don't get to speak very often. You know, we don't hear these stories in mainstream media a lot. It's a little bit more prominent sometimes. There's a hot issue or something, but how often do you really get to hear Keith Sokola or get to learn specific Native stories of Native voices who have lived these things, such as relocation, the occupation of Alcatraz,
the occupation of the BIA and all these other things that you don't really hear about that often. We are trying to do the best we can to bring those voices to you and to continue to uplift our community and speak out against settler colonialism and everything that comes with that. So if you want to support that and more, you can go to kboo.fm/give and donate today for the piece of a price of fry bread at a powwow. I know it's hard because we can't go to powwows right now, but for that amount, you could help support community radio today. So again, that's kboo.fm/give. We got a history lesson coming up and more music for you. And yeah, let's just get back into it.
Yeah. I'm in the woods of Wayland, Massachusetts. This is the town where I grew up. This part of town is mostly conservation land, but that wasn't always the case. In fact, this trail right here, this used to be an important stagecoach route called the Old Berlin Road, and was traveled extensively on during colonial times. These foundations are all that remain of a tavern that was once on the Old Berlin Road, a popular waypoint for travelers. Apparently, the tavern attracted some rather disreputable characters, including a semi-mythical highwayman named Captain Lightfoot.
It's said that Lightfoot was a careful man. Most highwaymen wore masks, but there was always a chance that one of their victims might identify them. So Lightfoot left nothing to chance.
According to local legend, a later owner of the tavern found 13 skeletons buried beneath the floorboards. It's been known as the Tavern of the Damned ever since.
There's a rich, forgotten history in this privileged suburban town. It's reflected in the ancient cemeteries, the historical markers, and on street signs. Place names can tell you a lot about history, and if you drive around here, you notice one name pop up over and over. King Philip. King Philip. King Philip.
But who was King Philip? Was he some French monarch who invaded New England? A mad rebel with ambitions to establish his own empire in the New World? Well, no. He was actually a Native American. King Philip was what the English called him, but his real name was Metacomet of Poconocon. And a generation after the first Thanksgiving, he led a coalition of Native American tribes to battle against the ever-encroaching English colonists of New England.
King Philip's War, the conflict that bears Metacomet's Christian name, was the bloodiest war per capita in American history. It shaped our national psyche, irrevocably changed the way colonists and Indians saw one another, and opened the door to Anglo-American domination of this continent.
In history class, this is what they tell you about the founding of our country. In 1620, the Pilgrims landed. And then in 1776, we declared our independence. They never seem to talk about what happened in between. And they should, because it is a fascinating story. There's so much history to get into, but just consider this a simple introduction to this violent, chaotic, messy, deeply cynical chapter in American history. This is the story of King Philip's War.
In 1675, there were four English colonies in New England. Massachusetts Bay, the largest, stretched from the Atlantic coast to the upper Connecticut River Valley. Plymouth centered around the Pilgrims Landing and incorporated Cape Cod. Connecticut was made up of port towns on Long Island Sound and farming communities up the Connecticut River to the modern-day border with Massachusetts. And then there's Rhode Island, the black sheep of the bunch. It was largely populated by Baptists, Quakers, and other religious exiles. About 20,000 white colonists lived in New England. For the most part, they were deeply religious Puritans who valued industry and evangelism above all else.
Blessed are the poor in spirit.
The Puritans' missionary work had been fairly successful. They had established several communities of praying Indians, Christian Algonquin people. The largest of these was Natick, Massachusetts. Praying Indians lived according to English customs, but did not enjoy the full rights of Englishmen. Most of them languished in poverty and dealt with constant prejudice from their white neighbors. The colonies were growing constantly in size, population, and political power. The Native Americans of New England, on the other hand, were being squeezed out of their ancestral lands. There were about 10,000 natives across the region in 1675. The major tribes were the Nipmuc, the Mohegan, the Narragansett, and the Wampanoag. Historically, relations between these tribes have been cool at best. Each tribe was ruled by a sachem, a paramount chief. The sachem of the Poconocet Wampanoag was Metacomet, King Philip himself. He was educated at Harvard, where he became intimately familiar with Puritan customs and probably spoke excellent English. But make no mistake, though he had spent much of his life amongst Europeans, he was not their friend.
In January 1675, Josiah Winslow, governor of the Plymouth Colony, took a meeting with John Sassamon, a praying Indian. Sassamon warned him that Metacomet was planning a major offensive against the English. His goal? To drive them back into the sea.
Later that month, John Sassamon's body was found beneath the ice of Assawampset Pond. His neck had been broken.
The English arrested three Wampanoag men in connection to the murder. Another praying Indian testified against them, and in June 1675, they were hanged. Soon word of the executions reached Mount Hope, Metacomet's homeland. The Wampanoag were outraged. In their view, the English had exceeded their authority and set a dangerous precedent.
2 weeks later, a band of Wampanoag warriors burned the town of Swansea in Plymouth to the ground and slaughtered many of its inhabitants. The English responded quickly. A joint military force of militia from Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay descended on Metacomet's base on Mount Hope. On June 27th, as the English militia prepared to sweep the Mount Hope Peninsula and destroy the Wampanoag, there was a total eclipse of the moon visible over Massachusetts. The militia grew apprehensive. Some said the eclipse, which lasted over an hour, was an evil omen. The Indians, however, saw it as a sign that ultimate victory would be theirs. Under cover of darkness, the Wampanoag boarded canoes and slipped away to Pocasset Country on the mainland to continue the fight. The English arrived at Mount Hope to find the Wampanoag wigwams deserted. Metacomet's escape ensured that the war would continue. Historians such as Douglas Edward Leach have suggested that war came before Metacomet was truly ready. Perhaps the attack on Swansea had been the work of a few hot-headed young warriors, acting contrary to Metacomet's orders. The Indians left no written records of the war, so we will never know for sure. But Metacomet did have one major tribe on his side.
The powerful Nipmuc of central Massachusetts. Over the course of the summer and the autumn, they staged daring raids on English settlements, sending the colonies into a panic.
The violence the Indians committed that summer was extreme. Men, women, children, and livestock were indiscriminately butchered, and the colonies seemed completely incapable of offering an effective defense.
The English militia commanders fighting in King Philip's War were mostly veterans of the English Civil War, and they were used to fighting on the green, verdant battlefields of their home country. But fighting against an ambush in a swamp is an entirely different matter.
In autumn, the Nipmuc attacked the Connecticut River Valley, driving farmers from their fields. So Massachusetts Bay Militia gathered what crops they could find, loaded the harvest into wagons, and proceeded to the town of Hadley. En route, their caravan was ambushed. A large force of Nipmuc warriors, led by their cunning sachem Muddawump, sprung from the trees and smashed the English at the Battle of Bloody Brook. The harvest of the upper Connecticut River Valley was lost. For the English, it would be a lean winter.
The onset of winter brought a lull in the fighting, which was extremely lucky for the English. In 6 months of war, they had failed to win a single military victory. The economic downturn caused by the razing of farms and homesteads was ruinous, and morale across the colonies was extremely low.
The Wampanoag and Nipmuc had crossed the Rubicon, but not all the tribes of the region were quite so eager to raise their tomahawks against the English. The Mohegan of Connecticut, for example, were enthusiastically allied with the colonists. The Narragansett, however, remained neutral. Despite a pledge of loyalty to the colonies, they bore no love for their white neighbors, and tensions between the two groups were high. If the Narragansett joined the war on Metacomet's side, they would be perfectly positioned to attack Massachusetts on one side and Connecticut on the other. Colonial leaders lived in constant fear of this possibility. The war was going badly enough. A major offensive from another hostile tribe could prove apocalyptic. So delegates from each of the United Colonies met in Boston. They decided to attack the Narragansett preemptively.
The colonies assembled an army of 1,000 men, the biggest New England had ever seen, and marched off to Rhode Island. On December 19, 1675, after marching for days through the frigid wilderness of the Great Swamp, the army came across a heavily fortified Narragansett village. They took a moment to gawk at the fortifications. They were unlike anything the Algonquin had ever built. Then the English set about destroying them.
The army discovered a weak point in the palisade, and soldiers led by Captain Samuel Mosley poured into the fort. Mosley was a cruel, racist Indian fighter. He thought of the natives like animals, so he slaughtered them like animals. When the smoke cleared, 600 Narragansett warriors and civilians were dead. Puritan historians described the Great Swamp fight as a glorious victory. It was, in truth, a needless slaughter that forced the Narragansett into the war.
Meanwhile, Metacomet and the Wampanoag wintered west of the Berkshires in the colony of New York. There, he attempted to convince the Mohawk tribe to enter into the war on his side. Instead, the Mohawk turned on him and nearly destroyed his army. Metacomet returned to Massachusetts in February 1676, his army crippled and his reputation damaged beyond repair. Spring brought more attacks on English villages. The natives were more ferocious and daring than ever, and their raids went all the way to the Atlantic coast. The last great Native American victory of the war was fought right here in Sudbury, Massachusetts in April 1676. 500 Wampanoag and Nipmuc warriors surrounded a unit of Massachusetts militia and wiped them out.
Nevertheless, the fire of Native resistance was burning down to its embers. The fearsome Nipmuc, who had inflicted worse defeats against the English than any other tribe, were effectively neutralized at the Battle of Turner's Falls in May 1676. As for the Wampanoag, starvation and disease were taking their toll. Throughout the spring and summer, hundreds of hostile natives gave up the fight and surrendered to colonial authorities. The English were also changing up their tactics. The colonies, especially Plymouth, had begun to appreciate the value of allied native scouts and warriors, who were expert trackers and born guerrilla fighters.
Metacomet saw the writing on the wall. He fled back to Mount Hope, his ancestral homeland. A dashing frontiersman named Captain Benjamin Church, commanding a small company of Englishmen and native allies, set off in pursuit. Church's men surrounded the Wampanoag camp at Mount Hope on August 12th before dawn. They took their positions and opened fire. During the battle, two of Church's men spotted a big Indian running through the forest. One of them, an Englishman, drew bead with his rifle, pulled the trigger, and the piece misfired. So his companion, a praying Indian named John Alderman, shouldered his rifle, took careful aim, and killed the fleeing man.
The two men approached the big Indian's corpse. They recognized him immediately. Metacomet of Poconoket, sachem of the Wampanoag, known to white men as King Philip.
Captain Church! They call him!
Apparently, Alderman cut off King Philip's hand, kept it in a jar, and showed it to people at taverns for a fee. Cheers. King Philip was dead, but several of his men survived the August 12th battle, including his shrewd chief lieutenant, the aged Annawan.
Captain Church, acting on information provided by Wampanoag prisoners, tracked Annawan to his camp, descending down a sheer cliff face to achieve the element of surprise.
But instead of fighting, Annawan decided to take a meal with Benjamin Church. He even presented him with Metacomet's own belt of wampum as a sign of respect. Despite Church's protests, though, Annawan was taken in chains to Plymouth and later executed.
As a young man, Annawan had probably attended the first Thanksgiving, but he lived to see his tribe extinguished and his way of life brutally repressed.
King Philip's war was a chaotic mess. The natives lost because of their lack of cohesion, as well as their inability to capitalize on their many strategic victories. The English won almost accidentally. Each campaign, each battle, was marred by incompetence at the highest level of command. In fact, officials in London were so unimpressed by colonial leadership during the war that in 1686, they passed legislation that directly reasserted their control over their American colonies. Not until 1776 would Americans enjoy nearly as much independence.
Most crucially, King Philip's war set a precedent for how Anglo-Americans would treat Native Americans, namely with slaughter, enslavement, and confinement on reservations. Throughout the war, hundreds of praying Indians who were suspected of colluding with the enemy were banished to a barren, windswept rock in Boston Harbor called Deer Island. Many of them starved or froze to death there. It was a deplorable policy, motivated by paranoia and blind hatred, and eerily foreshadowed Japanese internment during World War II.
Naturally, the newcomers looked about with some curiosity. They were in a new area, on land that was raw, untamed, but full of opportunity.
Those Wampanoag, Nipmuc, and Narragansett who survived King Philip's war fled west, to upstate New York and beyond. In June 1675,
the English and the natives had shared power in New England. 18 months later, the white man was the undisputed master of all the land from the sea to the Hudson River.
We all know there's a dark side to this country. The specter of Indian genocide looms over all of our flag waving, our apple pie, our baseball games. King Philip's War embodies that dark shadow, that conveniently forgotten history of theft, rape, mutilation, and slaughter. King Philip's War, the most important American war you've never heard of.
Your big eyes are finally opened. Now that you're wondering how must they feel, meaning them that you've chased across America's movie screens. Now that you're wondering how can it be real that the ones you've called colorful, noble, and proud in your school propaganda, they starve in their splendor. You've asked for my comment, I simply will render. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. Now that the longhouses breed superstition, you force us to send our toddlers away to your schools where they're taught to despise their traditions, forbid them their languages, then further say that American history really began when Columbus set sail out of Europe, and stress that the nation of leeches that's conquered this land are the biggest and bravest and boldest and best. And yet where in your history books is the tale of the genocide basic to this country's birth, of the preachers who lied, how the Bill of Rights failed, how a nation of patriots return to their earth? And where will it tell of the Liberty Bell as it rang with a thud over Kinzoa mud, and a brave Uncle Sam in Alaska this year? My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. Treaties attest, oh well, blankets for land is a bargain indeed. And the blankets were those Uncle Sam had collected from smallpox disease dying soldiers that day. And the tribes were wiped out and the history books censored. 100 years of your statesmen have felt it's better way. Yet a few of the conquered have somehow survived. Their blood runs the redder, though genes have been paled. From the Grand Canyon's caverns to Craven's sad hills, the wounded, the losers, the robbed sing their tale. From Los Angeles County to upstate New York, the white nation fattens while others grow lean. Oh, the tricked and evicted, they know what I mean. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. The past, it The future just threatens our lifeblood shut up in your chemical tanks. And now here you come, bill of sale in your hand, and surprise in your eyes that we're lacking in thanks for the blessings of civilization you've brought us, the lessons you've taught us, the ruin you've wrought us. Oh, see what our trust in America's bought us. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. Now that the pride of the sires receives charity, now that we're harmless and safe behind laws, now that my life's to be known as your heritage, now that even the graves have been robbed, now that our own chosen way is a novelty, hands on our hearts, we salute you, your choke on your blue, white, and scarlet hypocrisy, pitying the blindness that you've never seen, that the eagles of war whose wings lent you glory, they were never no more than carrion crows, pushed the wrens from their nest, stole their eggs, change their story. The mockingbird sings it, it's all that she knows. Ah, what can I do? Say a powerless few with a lump in your throat and a tear in your eye. Can't you see that their poverty's profiting you? My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying.
I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. You can find us online at Rose City Native Radio on Facebook. For music, events, and more, send them all to pdxnativeradio@gmail.com. If you want to support community radio, you can go to kboo.fm/give. I hope everybody's staying safe out there. Wash your hands, wear a mask, and as always, we will see you next weekend in country.
Demand awakening from the path we have taken as we brought it. Ignite. upright. Conduct yourself like lightning, because the retribution will be swift.
Oh, say, lie, 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 preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.